Around the year 1309, London was a powder keg. A heap of political factions were jostling to gain power in the city. These political factions were split over a series of issues, like maintaining good working relationships with the king, or responding to the swamping of the city by people from outside London moving here to work. You had the richer merchants of London, the mercers, pepperers, goldsmiths, drapers and moneylenders, who used their cash to dominate the position of the aldermen and from this effectively ran the city. And they were now having to cope with the rise of the crafts and trades, like the cordwainers and leather workers, carpenters and butchers, who wanted to regulate who could come into the city and to practice their professions. And in order to do that, they needed to gain increased political power, and so they were competing to gain political power. And you had foreign merchants, Italians, Germans and Gascons, who had recently gained a huge concession from the crown, which had weakened the city's liberties and rights, the Carta Mercatoria. It was a swirling political mess, but it was all self-contained and complete unto itself. But as previous episodes have shown, London does not exist in isolation. The rest of the country and the events therein could and would impact upon the city, and they were just about to. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the entire history of the city as one long narrative tale, broken into convenient small weekly chunks. We have reached our second anniversary. So this week, by way of celebration, I'm dropping two chapters of the story. And so we begin our celebrations with chapter 113, the second part in explaining how London gained its first true livery companies and how the actions of the King of England caused London to undergo a profound change. Welcome then to the second part of the Livery Wars, the Favoured Peacock. What did King Edward II do that so shook up London? Well, to genuinely shorten an awesome and fascinating story, Edward, the new king, was clearly in love with a young man called Piers Gaveston. Like, big wow, so the king was bi. It's not really that important. But that's me expressing a 21st century value here, and we're not talking about the 21st century, are we? This was the 14th century. And people mostly freaked out about the fact that the king was in love with a young man called Piers Gaveston. But while it's clear there was rampant homophobia going on, understand this was the king we're talking about, the anointed ruler of the land in whom the blessings of the Lord God Almighty had granted him rulership over all. If the king was gay, so what? In what follows, the issue is not so much the king being gay or bisexual, more that the man he loved, Piers Gaveston, he showered him with gifts and titles and was playing favourites. And England was a state where the political system could not cope with favourites. It was a land where the king had to navigate a kingdom, whereas accounted to his power a bunch of large landowners, the Earls of England, whom owned vast amounts of territory and could raise vast amounts of money and armed forces. And so the king's relationship with this young Frenchman had to navigate this particular shark-infested political waterway. And he did. Badly. So the heir to the throne and his amour had been introduced by the new king's late father, Edward I. Old King Edward had hoped Gaveston, a Gascon noble by birth, might become a positive influence upon his son. He certainly influenced him, for sure, but maybe not in the way the king had intended. We know that the heir to the throne, Edwin of Carnarvon as he was known then, developed a fondness for the young French noble and began to bestow gifts upon him. And this led to the most famous falling out between the old king and his heir to the throne. Prince Edward, now, by the way, styled the first ever Prince of Wales, had a hot and cold relationship with his father, but had been knighted by him in the event of the war against Robert the Bruce. The prince had travelled with his father for the first part of that war. Their campaign had been successful, though by no means conclusive. King Edward himself had played little part in it, for his health had begun to fail him, and English forces were led by the Earl of Pembroke. The Earl of Pembroke and Prince Edward had won the Battle of Methven and then besieged Kildemary Castle, where they'd taken it, and Robert the Bruce's queen, his sister, his daughter, and the Countess of Berkin were captured and then imprisoned in wooden cages, which were hung from the walls of the castles of Berwick and Roxburgh. This is just to remind you that King Edward I was a bit of a bastard. In the winter of 1307, as this was going on, with Robert Bruce on the run and clearly losing, the king and his son decided to visit Lanercost Priory up near Carlisle, and it was at this priory that their famous falling out took place. The story goes that the prince requested of his father if he could bestow a small title upon Piers Gaveston, the Count of Pottigny, which was a French estate he owned. Now, it might have been, from the prince's point of view, a reasonable request. After all, it wasn't a very large part of territory, and now Prince Edward was holding titles like Prince of Wales, Duke of Aquitaine, Earl of Chester. So, did it matter if he gave away just a little county to his new best friend? The old king saw things in a very different light. His answer to his son's request was, and I quote, "You base-born whore son, do you want to give lands away now, you who have never gained any? As the Lord lives, if it were not for fear of breaking up the kingdom, you should never enjoy your inheritance," unquote. And then he emphasised this point by grabbing his son by the hair and tearing out handfuls of it and then kicking him from the room. Evidently, the prince's affection for Piers Gaveston had now come to the king's notice, and it had rather alarmed him. And as a consequence of the prince's rash request, the old king banished Gaveston. The young Gascon was ordered to leave England by the end of April, and he and the Prince of Wales were both made to swear upon the Eucharist that the king's command would be obeyed. This being said, the king did allow the Prince of Wales to escort his best friend to Dover, and the prince then had him hang around until May, a little act of rebellion, but he did have to leave. But the prince did tell him not to go all the way to Gascony, but to stay near the English coast. The old king still granted a generous allowance to Piers Gaveston and ordered him merely to stay away until he was recalled. And presumably in his head that meant when his son's feelings had cooled, or maybe they'd married his son off and that would turn his head. The king, having formed a good opinion of Piers Gaveston in the first place, did not give it up. He blamed his son for such a silly infatuation. The Gascon was sent away, and the sulking Prince of Wales slowly returned north, and the king began renewing his campaign in Scotland. And it was there that Robert the Bruce won his first victory over the Earl of Pembroke at the Battle of Loudon Hill. By the beginning of July, the prince had still not caught up with his father, and the king had not quite reached the border. Determined to the last, Edward I struggled as far as the ford off the Solway River at Burren Sands, and there passed. With his death, on the morning of the 7th of July, Edward of Caernarfon became King of England, and inherited, besides a war which seemed to be turning against him, a kingdom with a mountain of debts. I mean, seriously, it was bad. The old king had left over £60,000 worth of debts. He'd borrowed heavily from the Florentine banking houses of Bardi and Frescobaldi. Soldiers, officials and tradesmen were walking around unpaid by the crown. The exchequer accounts were hopelessly in arrears. Edward inherited this chaos and had the unhappy obligation of having to impose order upon it, while at the same time he was expected to cope with a war that was turning against him. So what was his first act? What was King Edward's first decision faced with this mountain of problems? Yeah, it was to recall Piers Gaveston. Gaveston sailed back, and upon meeting Edward on the 6th of August, after the young king had gained the homage of his English lords in Carlisle and his Scottish lords in Dumfries, the king then decided to reward Piers by making him the Earl of Cornwall. This was big. The title usually went to members of the royal family, and it came with an awful lot of land, as well as all the land in Cornwall. It would have been far more normal or appropriate if King Edward had granted the earldom of Cornwall to one of his younger half-brothers, like Thomas of Brotherton or Edmund of Woodstock, the sons of his father by Margaret of France. But he didn't. He gave it to Piers, and giving him this title shocked a lot of people. In the early autumn of 1307, by the time he'd dispatched his father's corps south and had received all the homage he needed, he ruled that the campaigning season was virtually at an end, so the new king left the Earls of Richmond and Pembroke in charge of affairs in the war in Scotland, while he himself went south to meet his first Parliament and to attend the burial of his father. Parliament, held in Northampton in that October, agreed to giving funds for the old king's burial and for the new king's marriage and coronation, which were to follow fast upon each other. The funeral of Edward I took place on the 27th of October in Westminster Abbey. The great formal ceremony of state overtook the city of London. How did those political factions I mentioned feel as they laid to rest the colossus that had dominated London politics for so long? No doubt, several of the old ones could remember this king stealing the treasury of London from the Templar headquarters all those years ago, and bore with him deep-seated resentment. Others, however, their entire political fortunes had depended upon their close relationships with the king. London would have had very mixed feelings burying Edward I. The new king's marriage was arranged for the new year, and in the meantime, Edward then arranged for Piers Gaveston to marry his niece, Margaret de Clare, the daughter of his sister Joan, the Countess of Gloucester. This was an incredible high-profile marriage, and it's arguable that this was as big a shock as Piers Gaveston being made the Earl of Cornwall. I mean, what did this guy do to deserve such a marriage? And then another shock fell on this. In January 1308, when Edward III went to France to get married, Piers Gaveston was named and appointed the Regent of England over any of the other existing noble lords in the country. The giving of the title of Earl of Cornwall, the marriage to his niece, and now making him regent, all within a few months. If King Edward had deliberately set out to insult and alienate his noble lords, he could have scarcely have planned anything better. The marriage of Edward and Isabella of France took place in Boulogne that January, and to both the French and the English, the marriage seemed like a brilliant union, and it was a splendid and joyous event. The French were very impressed by the handsome young king, and the English equally impressed by the beautiful bride. The king and his new bride returned to the traditional adulation from the crowds of London, and then on February the 25th, 1308, Westminster witnessed the coronation of the new King of England, which was a complete and utter PR disaster. Piers Gaveston apparently turned up, quote, so decked out that he more resembled the god Mars than an ordinary mortal, unquote. Yeah, Piers, who'd been given the privilege of carrying the crown into the ceremony, turned up dressed in an outrageous royal purple silk outfit sewn in with pearls. And then at the coronation banquet, the king didn't even hide the fact that he preferred the company of Piers Gaveston. The queen's uncles, who had come with her all the way from France as an escort, saw how the king behaved during the wedding feast and left England in a fury, and they reported to the King of France that King Edward was more in love with his favourite than from his wife. And they'd good reason to say that, because during the wedding feast, Edward had even presented to Gaveston the best of the jewels and wedding presents that had been given to Queen Isabella. It must be said, Piers Gaveston had been previously somewhat circumspect in his behaviour when around the old king. But now he was safely encased with his new best friend, the new king. He's shown a sudden arrogance and pride. This young peacock was loving life, and by all accounts, honestly felt that as he was clearly the closest to the king everybody should treat him as the king's will in all things. The great landlords and noble magnates of England had enough on their plate right now without dealing with this peacock, but they had a way to redress the issue they felt. You see, during the coronation of Edward II, he'd taken a newly formulated version of the coronation oath. It contained a brand new fourth clause in addition to the usual three clauses the kings swore as they were given the crowns. In this fourth clause, the king promised to be held by the just laws and customs of the community of the realm, whatever they should determine. Now, this was probably included because, you know, the old king and the lords of England were occasional strangers. But this clause gave the nobility of England a way to combat Piers Gaveston. They claimed that since Piers had become possessor of lands which ought to be part of the crown, the Earldom of Cornwall, and because he had alienated the king from his powerful magnates, if they then demanded Piers Gaveston's removal, the king was bound by the fourth clause of his coronation oath to accept their demand. At the April Parliament of 1308, so we're only less than a year into his reign, a strong baronial group led by the old Earl of Lincoln, who had originally not been too bothered about Gaveston's elevation as the Earl of Cornwall, demanded Gaveston's immediate banishment from England. The Earl of Lincoln was supported by the Earls of Lancaster, Warwick, Hereford, Pembroke and Surrey. Only the King's cousin, the Earl of Richmond, and his nephew, Gilbert the Clare of Gloucester, didn't join this powerful opposition, but they didn't support the King, they were just being neutral. In fact, the only major landowner at the time who was on the King's side was Sir Hugh Despenser the Elder. And that one supporter provided no backup in which to resist such a strong wall of opposition. This being said, the king at first was determined to defend Gaveston's position against this, well, dubiously constitutional demand of the earls. It was only in the June of 1308, when they appeared at Westminster carrying arms, did the king at last capitulate and agree that Piers Gaveston should forfeit his titles and be gone from England by the 25th of the month. Edward did what he could to mitigate the decline of Piers's fortunes. He gave his favourite castles and manors in England and Aquitaine, and he granted him the grand title of the King's Lieutenant in Ireland, to where he sent Piers over to run the English possessions there. The King escorted Piers to Bristol, and watched sadly as he departed by boat. This Gascon had taken less than a year to piss off that many nobles in England, and the King of England was showing to all the world that he really could not read the room. And he wanted Piers Gaveston back. And so he began a charm offensive on his opposition in the hopes of splitting them and dividing them, and then that way he could get his favourite back. There were a lot of issues going on in the country, but this was the one he was focusing upon. The Lords of England realised they would need to help the new king run the nation, whether he wanted that help or not. When Parliament met at Westminster in April 1309, Edward hoped that this charm campaign would have worked, but not only had it not, but he found himself faced by an opposition party which demanded his consent to a complex programme of reforms, including regulation of the purveyance, aka the right of the Crown to obtain provisions at a reduced price, the limitation of the powers of royal officials, and a full reform of the royal household. Oh look, the royal court's expenditure was up for reform, eh? Across London, dozens of mercantile interests would have had their ears prick up at that. Some were hoping for it, some were terrified by it. The king responded to this by showing his obsessive state of mind and came up with a counter-proposal. He said he'd agree to all of those reforms, every single one of them, in return for them recalling and reinstating Piers Gaveston. Seriously? The Lords refused this offer and Parliament was adjourned to Stamford, where a new session was to take place in that July. But that charm offensive the King had been doing finally paid off during the 3 months in between the two parliaments, and the opposition towards Piers Gaveston's restoral was split, and the king regained the support of the Earls of Lincoln, Pembroke and Surrey. Gaveston was therefore recalled. Edward rode joyously to Chester to receive him, and they together went to the Parliament at Stamford. With Gaveston once more at his side, Edward was willing enough to agree to the demands of what remained of the opposition. Yes, you could regulate the purveyance, you could reform the household. I have peers. But by that Christmas, the utter contempt towards this young man and bewilderment at the king's insistence at constantly supporting him just grew to breaking point. And when in February 1310, Parliament met at Westminster, the king decided to send Gaveston to the north to ensure his personal safety and went to Westminster accompanied by Gloucester, Richmond and Surrey to meet the opposition. The Parliament presented to King a long list of grievances and demanded that a commission should be set up empowered to implement all the reforms which they considered important. Faced with this large body of nobles demanding reform, the King had to, well, back down, and a new committee was established to counter the King, who called themselves the Lords Ordainers. Now, the Lords Ordainers were a 21-member committee, and I could spend an hour trying to explain how people got onto the Lords Ordainers and still not do it justice. But basically, they're a reform committee and they issued 6 preliminary ordinances and then settled down to work out a nationwide reform programme. Edward II responded to the Lords Ordainers by ignoring them at first and then trying to disrupt it all by breaking it all up. He decided to leave Westminster and he commanded the Chancellor, quote, with the Great Seal and all the Chancery, to follow him wherever he went, unquote. The Chancellor said he couldn't, as the Lords Ordainers were reforming stuff, and he should stick around for that. The King fired him and then got a new Chancellor. By September, the King had the idea that he was now going to launch an attack upon the Scots, and that all the nobles and powers of the land should come to Scotland to help him, as it was only the Earls of Warwick and the Earl of Gloucester who sent forces, and that meant they pulled out of the Lords Ordainers, which carried on, and it now meant the King didn't really have much of an army. Edward directed the war from Berwick in Scotland, and Piers Gaveston did show some personal bravery. But whatever the King did, the Lords Ordainers carried on with the reform of the government. And this is where London and its complicated factions suddenly found themselves around 1311. Both sides in the ongoing argument about who should run England and how it should be run fully understood the importance of holding and controlling London. It provided the wealth, the strategic advantage and the manpower which could influence this national conflict. And whoever held it commanded the prestige which came from holding the largest city in the kingdom. But to control London, you needed to gain the support of one of London's new political factions. And to these groups now came the full force of the king and his opposition barons, seeking to support someone to help be dominant over London. Stimulated by these external issues, London's politics dissolved from 1311 into warring interests, definable not by conflicts of class or craft, but by the sectional economic interests which formed round basically the related issues of the wool trade and the city's traditional rights. Ultimately, the outcome of this struggle would be decided by the Crown's policy towards those two issues, and also the issue of the freedom the Crown gave to foreigners to trade in London. In pursuit of their own interests, the rival merchant groups sought the support of the national contestants and also manoeuvred for alliances with the retailers and craftsmen in London. In doing so, they sharpened the divisions between themselves, which began to be displayed outwardly by people starting to wear craft liveries. A livery is a uniform, and so here we are, and in response to the political arguments about to break out, we see the factions adopt uniforms as they gathered and assembled. Butchers and their people wore a different livery to the Cordwainers and their people who wore a different livery to the men who were loyal to the Pepperers. London began to be divided into gangs, motivated by political argument and all wearing uniforms displaying who they were and what they supported. And these groups changed allies and allegiances in response to the political shifts which would threaten their issues as the story goes forward. London's politics seethed in a turmoil the like of which had never been seen before. And it was the struggle that followed that the unity of the city's mercantile class was split and the rivalries of the livery companies were born. And all this trouble did not initially spring from conflicts within the city. The pressure first came from the king. In 1308, the six-year rule of Mayor John LeBlund came to an end. He'd been a true loyalist to Edward I. He'd also even gone as far as to travel north to fight alongside the king in Scotland. And in 1306, he'd received his knighthood for his service to the king. Sir John LeBlund was the first mayor of London to ever receive a knighthood. In 1308, Sir John was replaced as mayor by a goldsmith, Nicholas de Farndon. De Farndon was clearly a migrant to the city, probably of French origin, and he'd been born Nicholas Le Fevre, son of Ralph de Fevre, but somewhere along the way he'd married a young woman called Isabella, the sole daughter and heiress of William de Farndon, a London goldsmith and alderman of the ward Farringdon Within. Upon marrying her, Nicholas took his father-in-law's surname, and then when his father-in-law died, he inherited his ward, and Nicholas de Farndon became alderman around 1293 or so. And then in 1308, he became mayor. Farndon was to be a bit of a player in the struggles to come and would hold the position of mayor four times over the years. It is significant that he is listed as a goldsmith. Nicholas de Farndon was to be the only goldsmith to hold the position for decades. And he certainly seems to have represented a political faction aligned with the goldsmith and bullion dealers of London, and by extension, aligned with the crown. In 1308, brand new mayor Nicholas de Farndon received a request from the king and Piers Gaveston, and from a few of their supporters, that they had a nominee for someone to collect the small beam. The small beam was the name of a tax collected in London on high-end cloths. It was very important to the mercers, and the collection of the small beam was something the mercers were really focused upon. However, Nicholas de Farndon had no wish to antagonise these powerful men at court, and so the small beam was handed over to a friend of the king's. London's powers and traditional rights were being eroded more, it seemed. This annoyed the hell out of those who opposed such things, and they responded angrily. In 1309, a new mayor took office, but he was very different. He was a Pepperer and a former hardline sheriff, Thomas Romaine. And no sooner had he taken office than he received an identical request from the king and Piers Gaveston. Hand over the small beam, will you, old chap? Romaine was made of a different metal to Farndon. He saw that if the royal demands were not resisted, the city could continue to provide pickings for the vultures of the court. Death by a thousand small cuts. I mean, the next thing they could ask for was control of the Great Beam, which was a much larger tax collected in London to do with wool. However, Thomas Romaine also realised that if the foreign merchants continued to complain to the king about London's refusal to agree about how goods were being weighed, the king could use that as an excuse to seize the Great Beam. So Thomas Romaine responded in two ways. Firstly, he told the king and Piers Gaveston firmly that the office they wanted of collecting the small beam, it's already been filled. But then, as I mentioned last episode, he made concessions over how goods were weighed in London to bring it in line with the Carta Mercatoria, which had been issued 6 years previously. But if he was hoping this would ease the pressure, Mayor Romaine was to be disappointed. The king kept up the pressure and things got tougher. It did not help that the winter of 1309 was an exceptionally hard one. The Thames froze to ice so thick that it actually became a highway you could travel upon from Southwark to Westminster. And apparently you could light fires on the ice right in the middle, and it made no dent upon it. Bread froze even as it was given a protective covering of straw. Food became scarce, and the poor of London began to suffer. The king used this to increase pressure on the mayor. He set up a commission to inquire into complaints he'd heard about people preventing supplies from being given to the poor, and of excessive taxation. And the proceeds of that taxation, he'd heard, were being misappropriated. The accusations were nonsense, but the inquiry was a weapon which could be used against the heir and the aldermen if they resisted royal demands. And the king proved it was a weapon, because shortly afterwards he requested that a man called John Van and two other friends of his should be excused from all the taxes and from all public service in London, even if they are citizens of the place. Thomas Romaine was walking a tightrope as a mayor. He had to protect the interests of the merchants against the demands of the kings and his hangers-on. And he was conscious of the clamours of retailers, particularly the vintners, for protection against the hated Gascons, whom the king favoured. Like all the other foreigners, they were exploiting the holes made in the city's Charter of Liberties by the Carta Mercatoria. That bitter winter was threatening the lifeblood of the city. But then, as the Thames thawed, the rebellious barons rode into Westminster in full military array, demanding redress from the king of their grievances, which I mentioned just a bit ago. And that immediately offered a ray of hope. Which side should the mayor support? The poorer citizens and some of the mercantile missionaries were no doubt that Edward's agreement under duress in March 1310 to the appointment of 21 barons, the ordainers, was a signal. We need to support them, and while we're at it, let's go attack some Gascons. The ordainers were indeed now deciding to reform the realm and the royal household. But even so, it was dangerous to assume royal power was weakening. The king ordered the constable of the tower and the keeper of the wardrobe to see that the mayor and the aldermen protected the Gascons from any dangers. Romaine not only agreed to it, but then found it expedient to hedge his bets once again, and he decided to concede the demand for the small beam to the royal party, but he decided to surrender it to a nominee of Queen Isabella, a man called Richard de Reading. Please note, the Mercers had their own means of resistance to this. They were furious, and basically 3 years later, Reading returned the small beam to the city on the grounds that the purchasers of silk, aka the Mercers, were boycotting it. And as such, he wasn't making any money from it and was out of pocket. Mayor Thomas Romaine's political skills had been simply keeping the opposing forces of London in check, preventing violence and preventing instability. But as the ordainers consolidated their position and initiated their reforms, they made a bid for the support of London's governing class by including measures such as restrictions on the king's power to change the currency, which probably referred to his father's actions in the monetary crisis I covered last chapter. Popular feeling to support the Lords Ordainers amidst the aldermen and amidst the commons of London began to grow. And in the wake of this, in 1310, the city replaced Mayor Thomas Romaine with a powerful mercer, Richard de Reefham. A mercer was in charge of the city, the faction with the longest opposition to the influence of foreigners upon London. The thinking went, the new mayor would be, since he came from the profession long associated with limiting the influence of foreigners upon London, the ideal man to lead London into closer ties with the reformers over in the Lords Ordainers. But, as I said last episode, the mercers, while they were long disgruntled by the growth in power of foreign cloth merchants, paradoxically, they relied on these foreign merchants the most. And this paradoxical position caused Mayor Reefham to stumble into a total political disaster. Mayor Reefham took office just as the Lord Ordainers produced a document containing their ordinances on the 5th of October 1310. The document contained 41 articles. In the preamble, the Ordainers voiced their concern over what they perceived as the evil counsellors of the king, the precariousness of the military situation in Scotland, and the dangers of a possible rebellion in England due to the punitive taxes of the king. The articles can be divided into different groups, the largest of which deals with limitations upon the powers of the king and his officials, and to substitute these powers with baronial control. The king could now only appoint officers, quote, by the council and assent of the baronage, that in parliament, unquote. Furthermore, the king could no longer go to war without consent of the parliament, nor could he make any reforms of coins without consent of the parliament. And in addition, it was decided that the parliament should meet at least once a year. And parallel to these were reforms of the royal finances. The ordinances banned what they're seen as extortionate taxes and customs rates, and at the same time declared that revenues were to be paid directly into the exchequer. Other articles dealt with punishing specific persons, foremost amongst these, Piers Gaveston. Article 20 describes at length the offences committed by Gaveston, and he was once again condemned to exile, stripped of the title of Earl of Cornwall, and was to abjure the realm on the 1st of November. But Piers Gaveston was not the only individual who the Lords Ordainers took exception to. They also went after the banker, Amerigo di Frescobaldi. Not only was he the greatest of the king's creditors, but the loans which the king was able to raise from him and other financiers gave the crown a certain amount of financial independence, which the Ordainers saw as a threat to their influence. Furthermore, Frescobaldi held the post of the Constable of Bordeaux, which meant there was this huge other issue, as the mayor of Bordeaux at the time was a member of the Calhoun family, and the Calhouns were related to Piers Gaveston, as his mother was a member of that dynasty, and Gaveston was in the habit of banking vast sums of money which he received from the king, both with the Calhouns and the Frescobaldi. And there was enough smoke to convince everyone that if Piers Gaveston was lighting fires of graft and corruption, Amerigo di Frescobaldi was also involved in handing him the matches. And thus, as a follow-on to this, in July 1311, the Lords Ordainers had ordered the arrest of members of the Frescobaldi banking house in London. And they were arrested, no doubt to the cheers of many a Londoner. Mayor Richard de Reefham, however, received a letter from the king demanding he release these bankers. He tried to ignore it, but at the second request, Mayor de Reefham obeyed. This mayor, a powerful mercer, was in a no-win situation. He himself traded extensively with Italians and relied upon their import for his business. If they ceased to come to London, say, he and other rich mercers and pepperers would see their trade collapse. And besides, he was not willing to formally disobey the king like this. The retailers amongst the pepperers and the spices of Cheapside had a different outlook. To them, the Italians had been rivals in trade and chief enemies of the city's cherished liberties, which they relied upon for their protection. Their outlook was also shared by the majority of the mercers in London, who had organised themselves by 1304 into a powerful group, the Community of the Mercery of London. The release of the Frescobaldi by a mayor off their own trade, at the behest of the king and in opposition to the Lords Ordainers, could only be viewed as an act of treachery by these Londoners. The political knives came out real fast. And Mayor Richard de Reefham suddenly found himself embroiled in a row with members of his own profession. He ended up having to confiscate the goods of 8 mercers, apparently for failing to redeem a debt, and then accused his predecessor Romaine, another alderman, of making a false record of that debt. And yet there is evidence that he walked into a political trap, because the leader of the 8 mercers was a man called William de Hackford, who would become an agent of chaos in the city for years to come. Hackford was a radical, always pushing London towards siding against the king, and was effectively the leader or most high-profile champion of the London First and Screw Everybody Else party in the city. The upshot of it all was that Mayor de Reefham was mysteriously deprived of his position of alderman in 1312, probably by the machinations of his fellow mercers, and as such, he fell from power. Reefham was deposed as mayor, and this sent a signal to the Lords Ordainers that London's wholehearted support against the king was possible. All they needed was to give the city the correct incentive, and they gained that support. Because in July 1311, they said they would tear up the Carta Mercatoria and with it the foreigners' charters of liberties. London had won, but in this complicated city of confusing politics, it was hard to say who exactly had won. And I'm going to pause there. Thanks for listening. That was this week's first chapter. Coming immediately up in the next 24 to 48 hours, chapter 114 of The Story of London, a sudden eruption of unexpected violence. Thanks for listening. Bye.